Welcome to the Catskill Review of Books, a weekly program interviewing authors, hosted by Ian Williams and produced by Kevin Greff in the hydro-powered studios of WJFF in Jeffersonville.
Hello, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and this week I'm talking to Richard Courtney, one of the co-authors with George Cassidy of Come Together, The Business Wisdom of the Beatles. And this is doubly appealing to me since I'm a citizen of Liverpool originally, and my youth club actually turned the Beatles down because the the grabbing swine wanted £40 for a gig, and we got the Searchers for 20 instead.
Oh, what a deal.
One of my better stories. But I mean, I was very young but very precocious, but I do remember those days when basically your standard Liverpool group was £3 for the full sort of three guitars and a drummer lineup.
That's great.
And so £40 put them in the big league even then. But why did you pick on the Beatles as an example of business success? Because even in your own book, you show that they made so many wrong turnings that they had to be blessed by fortune or whichever Hindu gods George Harrison was praying to to dig themselves out of some of the holes they fell into.
Well, that's true, of course. And the thing is that we took the Beatles' entire career, actually their whole lives, and looked at it as a business model, and derived wisdom from their successes and their failures, which is what, of course, business is. So we were very drawn to the fact that they did somehow withstand all these missteps along the way and rebound, and of course it was their talent and their musical abilities that pulled them through. But the fact is, as you know, they were well managed, and some of the examples that people use of poor business judgment, such as their first recording contract, is the only contract they had, so they were turned down by everyone else, so that it was the only one they could take. So actually taking it was a wise business move, even though it seems in retrospect that the royalties were considerably low.
I mean, you're writing. Have you written any others in this genre? My favorite was The Business Secrets of Attila the Hun, who sounded like that was written about 10 years ago, I think, and it sounded like a sort of fairly accurate metaphor for some of the hedge fund operations at the time.
Right. Well, that might be the manual they used. No, I'd never done that. I had a real estate book published, Buyers Are Liars and Sellers Are Too, by Simon & Schuster back in 06, and I'm a columnist here in Nashville, where I've written weekly columns for the last 12 years or so. And then George, my partner, who's not with me today, is a business writer who's written several business books and been translated in 6 or 7 different languages. And he's also a recording engineer and a songwriter, so it's a good pair, a good partnership to work together to examine the Beatles' career, the pitfalls and their successes, and take them and show that how that can be incorporated into any business. A real estate agent, insurance agent, a bank, or anyone can take learn from their examples.
Yeah, and I have to say that you make a far more convincing case about the Beatles than the previous author did about Attila the Hun on a sound historical precedent.
Well, he had his successes, Attila.
Well, he lost in the end.
Yes, he did.
And he wasn't exactly remembered for his constructive activity, was he?
No, there's as we put in the book, there's a time to channel your inner Alan Klein, and there's a time in business when people need to channel Attila the Hun for a day or two, maybe.
Are you putting Alan Klein and Attila the Hun on a par here? I mean, that's the way that some of the Beatles seem to have regarded him at the time.
I think so. I think that's a fair analogy.
you'll go right back in to the beginning. And Brian Epstein, the first manager of the Beatles, well, he's not the first manager. In fact, my namesake, Alan Williams, was the first manager. He used to live 3 doors away from me, and had spent many years after the Beatles left drinking himself into the gutter every evening in sadness over being the one who gave the Beatles away the first time. I think that was his book, The Man Who Gave the Beatles Away.
Right, I can understand why he would do that.
Well, frankly, I don't think he so much gave them away as he lost them one night while he was in the pub.
Yeah, Yeah, that was not an amicable parting of the ways, I don't think.
No, I used to pick him up on the way home and find him in the gutter and take him home to his wife because he lived a few doors away from me.
Oh, that's nice. You've lived a life that I only dream about. I would love to be able to say the things you say about all those characters in Liverpool and from the Beatles to lore.
Well, we actually, I mean, when they first played in Liverpool in the Cavern, they always gave those number of, what, a couple of hundred sessions, and what they didn't mention was that they were usually played in the interval with a New Orleans-style, what we call trad in Britain, a New Orleans-style jazz band, the Mersey-Sippy Jazz Band, which is still going.
Wow, do they still play the Cavern?
Yes, I think they have done occasionally. I mean, they're all getting a bit long in the tooth now, as you can imagine. I think they were sort of fairly senior to the Beatles even then.
Right. Well, now there are two caverns across the street from each other. Which one was the original?
Aha, this is the other secret. Neither of them was the original.
Oh, I knew this. Where was the original?
The original was just a few doors along, and it was a really dank basement, which was totally unsafe because there was just one narrow staircase going down several stories underground. And it was... It was in the path of Liverpool's new underground railway. So a railway runs through it now, and they sort of found another cellar nearby and resurrected that. The other reason that the Cavern closed, which is not recorded, you're bringing all these memories back, we should be talking about your book, but it shows the background, was that the Cavern was below the sewage system, so all the bathrooms drained into an old water well for the sugar refineries. So there was a 36-foot deep cesspit, which was about 18-foot filled when they closed it.
Oh, no. Well, I'm glad I missed that one, maybe.
Well, there's an old saying in that part of England, where there's muck, there's brass, and the Beatles proved it. There was plenty of muck. But, you know, we're talking about Brian Epstein with this, and, I mean, you point out what a fascinating character he was, but, you know, he was... The rumour in Liverpool was that to get Love Me Do in the charts, he actually sent people round buying it up in bulk from the record stores that were used to compile the charts. And, you know, the rumour is always that someone somewhere, there's a basement in Liverpool filled with hundreds of mint copies, thousands of mint copies of Love Me Do that his agents purchased.
Right. I heard Paul McCartney say that in an interview one time, that... They said, where did all your money go? And he said, well, someone had to pay for all those copies of Love Me Do that Brian bought.
Well, so it's a standard rumor, and if he said it, it must be true as well, of course.
That's right.
Yeah. But then he went ahead and negotiated. You said that you about it, but it really was a very poor deal he negotiated in the end. And he, you know, for a sort of backstreet, well, okay, he was a sort of major musical magnat in Liverpool, but on the global terms, he just seemed out of his depth once he hit the big time, didn't he?
Well, certainly, but the same thing is like when I had my contract for this book, I'd been turned down about as many times as the Beatles had, and then I got the contract and I sent it to my attorney and I said, I'd like you to review it, and he said, why? And I said, well, to see if I should sign it. And he said, how many other offers do you have? And I said, well, I don't have any. And he said, well, sign this one. I mean, and that's what Brian did. He had an unsellable commodity, as rare, as odd as that seems to all of us today. But you certainly know. I mean, they knocked around Liverpool and Hamburg and all over northern England. And you know, certainly they were starting to pack the halls a little bit then and sell some records, but they weren't a polished recording act, and they weren't able to, and the choice of the songs they used on the Decca audition still baffles me.
My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean is the most baffling of all, isn't
love
it?
Love of the Loved and Three Cool Cats, and they had George on lead on three of them, which is strange, Sheik of Araby, and so Brian got them the only deal they could get, and that catapulted them into what became this huge success. And he was quick to renegotiate their record deal, and unfortunately for him, the records, the recordings have been released in so many different media now, through the certainly through iTunes recently, but then even back then the cassettes and the 8-tracks and the CDs eventually. So they had a higher rate that Epstein got them, and then another one that Klein was able to renegotiate. So they only suffered for, you know, making millions and millions of dollars for a few years, and certainly they probably left what would, in today's market, be $1 billion slip through their fingers. But they did okay.
No, I'm certainly not going to pass around a collecting bucket for them any time.
That's right.
You know, poverty is relative.
Yeah, they never were want for money. Do you know Tony Bramwell?
Yes, I saw him, and I don't know him personally, but he invented the video, the pop video, didn't he?
Right, and he's been to four of our Beatles festivals here. I've gotten to know him fairly well, and then the monies that he generated through the invention of the pop video, and he'd record basically their rehearsals and sell them to American Bandstand and here in America, Hullabaloo in Australia, and all those for $10,000 a piece. That was an amazing thing. And one thing Epstein and Bramwell and others in their camp did is that they were able to create enormous new revenue streams that had never been associated with pop rock musicians at the time. So for his shortcomings, he also had a number of breakthrough ideas, and his ability to manage them through a work year where they would record two records and make a movie every year and write songs for three albums and tour the world two or three times and appear on all these radio and TV. It was just an amazing situation with the way it is of scheduling and really strategies to build them up to where they are. So I think we can all derive wisdom from that and apply it to our lives.
Well, you know, people from Liverpool, I can personally testify, tend to have a streak of cynicism and doubt about people offering to help them. But in many ways, both with Brian Epstein and then Dick James, who came later and invented Northern Songs, really does seem to have taken them for a ride in terms of the amount of money they made out of it.
Yeah, potentially. The other thing that you have to look at is here in town, you know, in Nashville, we are a songwriting mecca, and it's very rare and really a recent phenomenon that the writers shared in the publishing of the songs with the publisher. The writers had the writer share and the publishers had the publisher share. So Dick James Music, once again, they were really way ahead of their time in as much as with Northern Songs, they owned not only, they always retained the writer's portion, but they also started to own portions of the publisher's portion of the rights and royalties that would come in from mechanicals and also for
he wasn't as sort of gouging with them as it almost appeared from your book when he actually sold the shares without telling them.
Yeah, he shouldn't have done that. I mean, that's the thing that and they share, I think, somewhat in that responsibility. And of course, McCartney will never make that mistake again, especially after the Michael Jackson incident. But I think they learned from that is that they needed to pay more attention to what was going on out there, because the fact that they woke up one day and part of their publishing had been sold without them having the opportunity to buy it was certainly something that should not have happened.
Yeah. This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and I'm talking to Richard Courtney, who is co-author with George Cassidy, who sadly couldn't make it to the phone today, authors of Come Together, The Business Wisdom of the Beatles. And since we're talking about business wisdom, following on from that, we should explain that Northern Songs owned the Lennon-McCartney corpus of songs. Dick James, who floated the company, sold his shares onto the market, which might have made an astute move, except he didn't tell them. That's what we're just talking about. But Michael Jackson had them at one point. Does he still now, or has he had to discourage them?
He still has, his estate has them, and most people are under the assumption that McCartney's making every move he can to get them back, because he had an opportunity to buy them when Michael Jackson bought them, and that was something that Paul seems to regret to this day, that he allowed his catalog to get away from him, and the fact that Michael Jackson, who he considered a friend, actually beat him out of that of that possession. And the next time he goes at it, I don't think Paul will partner with Yoko on it, and we'll pursue it solo.
I don't think there's much love lost there.
I don't think so.
But you also, you're talking, I think, one point where I thought you might be sort of don't speak ill of the dead is when you're describing Elvis Presley, because the Beatles idolized Elvis Presley, but I got the distinct impression from other biographies of Elvis that he pretty much detested them as Johnny-come-latelys and uppity rivals.
I think he was intimidated by them, and I don't think he understood them. He later recorded some of their songs later in his career, but the meeting that they had together was, and I'm certain you've read about it, in Hollywood, where they came and he was playing a bass guitar, and they sat around him for a long time. No one would talk, because the Beatles were certainly in awe of him. I think he was slightly intimidated by them. He did not have much self-esteem, as we've learned through what we know now. And he said, well, if no one's going to talk, I'm just going to go to bed. And then they started talking and playing pool, and Paul taught him some licks on the bass guitar. And they seemed to get along fairly well. Of course, later we learned that he actually turned them into a Richard Nixon, as John Lennon in particular, as a drug trafficker, and tried to have him removed from the United States. So I think it's something that Elvis never got over, really. I think his paranoia destroyed him on that one.
Yeah, it's always check your idols for feet of clay and pockets full of pills, I suppose, is the motto.
That's right. Yeah, he had a few buckets of him.
it's the idea that he was denouncing.
It was a strange time.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, let's say from your point of view as a business writer, what came first, the idea that you wanted to show the secrets of a successful business, or was it that your sort of obvious, fandom for the Beatles and what they stood for, that let's look at this and see how it works?
Well, what happened actually is one day my wife, who's a business executive here in Nashville, mentioned something that had happened in her world, and I said, that must be the way Paul McCartney felt when John Lennon showed him the Two Virgins album cover and says, this album's coming out soon. And of course, they were still Beatles at the time and had the two frontal photographs of John and Yoko, frontal with them nude. And she said, why is it that every time I tell you anything about my business, you tell me how it relates to the Beatles? Does everything in business relate to the Beatles? So with that challenge, I moved forward and found that everything in business does, in fact, relate to the Beatles. Imaging and branding and finding one's tree, or which is one, you know, one's niche. We refer to knowing, I think, is in my tree, is that people in business need to find their own tree and climb that tree and get on their own branch, however perilous it may seem. And that John really had a mission statement when he said we want to be the greatest rock and roll band in the history of the world. He compiled and memorialized a mission statement just like any other corporation would do. They didn't want to be sued. As a matter of fact, at the time they detested business people themselves, and the only time they were bad business people is when they were trying to be business people. When they weren't business people, they were quite good at it, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, the Apple Corporation in the early days was a sort of classic it was a hippie shambles, wasn't it?
It was. But the one thing that turned us around on the book, because when we started writing it, we thought there would be more mistakes along the way. But we were speaking with one of your Liverpudlian mates, Joey Molland, who we've gotten to know from the Apple band Badfinger, and I said, "Do you have trouble getting your royalty checks out of Apple?" Because he was considering buying a house here in town. I'm a realtor here in town still, and he said, "Oh no, Apple actually saved Badfinger, because they, once things started to go south on Badfinger with their manager stealing all their money, Neil Aspinall running Apple, put all the Badfinger royalties in receivership. And so he protected Badfinger. So Apple Records actually was an advocate for its clientele, that being Badfinger. So they've pulled some shrewd business maneuvers through the years, and it's only that window of Apple Boutique and Apple Electronics and Apple Films when they got into areas where they didn't have expertise in order to pull things off, which is what people, and we see that with athletes all the time, that they open a restaurant and they don't know anything about opening a restaurant. And so people need to stay within their means and their own limitations. And once the Beatles got outside music, they flopped.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I was going to say. Isn't one of the lessons of business of diversifying your investment? How do you diversify if you're a beetle?
Well, you diversify with the different revenue streams, with selling the videos and making movies and touring and writing songs and recording songs, writing books and sheet music. But you stay, you diversify within your field of expertise, I think.
Yeah, it's the fact that this is a sort of almost inexhaustible seam of gold. We're talking almost 50 years now since they started. God, that's making me feel even older than I first thought. but you know, the with the anthology and stuff like that, it's still in perennial demand, and not just from the aging baby boomer contemporaries.
It's people. George and I spoke this morning to a group of business people, and it's amazing. Several things are amazing. First is how little people know about the Beatles, really, and second is how interested they still are. And for every age group, in this group, we have people from 22 to 23 to 75 years old, and the and this is here in Nashville, Tennessee, and the interest level is insane. And we'll be in Chicago at the Beatles Festival there next month in August, and you know, they have 45,000 people make that trek every year to that Beatles Festival. It's amazing.
Wow, why don't they go to Liverpool and boost the tourism revenues in a depressed city?
Yeah, I think there's one in August, a couple of years ago when they had, what was the cultural arts?
The city culture of the European City of Culture.
Right, they had a festival that year and had 250,000 there.
Yeah, I mean, even in those early years afterwards, we got lots of, Liverpool was a bit like the Isle of the Lotus Eaters. We had lots of Americans who would come to the home of the Beatles, and like you, they were so attracted to the place they couldn't get themselves out. You know,
right? Yeah, I just love it there.
You know, they lived it. They naturalized. They went to the pubs. They hung around. Discovered Liverpool poets and many other things that were very available in Liverpool at the time.
Oh, it's just a beautiful city. You should be proud of it.
Sure
you are. There's much more than the Beatles, that's for sure. It's not dank and dark. It's open and lively and lovely and full of wonderful people and creativity. It's amazing. It's an amazing place.
Yes, even after I left, all of that is true.
Yeah, it's surprising. I ask everyone where you were, and they said you'd come over here. I'm sorry to have missed you.
Getting back to the business part of this, out of the survivors, I mean, some of them... it's interesting, some of the other ventures. You didn't mention, for example, don't think that... George Harris rescued Life of Brian, for example, which was a very shrewd investment, even if it was sort of quasi-theologically or anti-theologically motivated.
Right. We actually stopped with the Beatles, and we didn't go into their solo careers. So that's the next book, maybe. Except we have to do the Rolling Stones.
You have to do the Rolling Stones in between. That's a big in between, isn't it?
Beatles, Stones, then solo Beatles.
Well, you mentioned, I think many of us, album that each of them made after they went solo was brilliant. But afterwards, you really began to appreciate how much you needed the cocktail for it to work properly.
That's exactly right. And that speaks well to the partnership. And that's, once again, in any business situation, is to find a partner with skills and a partner that you respect. Because Lennon or any of the four Beatles could go in a studio, and if they played something that sounded horrible and they looked around at the other musicians, no one there is going to say, well, that's really bad, you shouldn't play it that way, other than maybe George Martin. So they were really at the mercy of themselves, which is not a good place to be. People need that objectivity of a third party, a manager, a producer, or a partner.
Also, I'd never really hadn't totally appreciated your point. George Harris was the one who was actually, to some extent, held down by both the Lennon-McCartney partnership and then the Lennon-McCartney rivalry afterwards. He was the one who really blossomed towards the end. Climbing out of the ruins, sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, on the album Abbey Road, the last one they recorded, even though we know Let It Be was released later, Something and Here Comes the Sun are the marquee songs of that album, I think. And that must have been really frustrating. And that's one reason All Things Must Pass was so good. And, you know, it was a double record. It was George's first solo work because he had all the songs left over that the Beatles wouldn't let him record. So he had a wealth of great material.
What should they have done to maintain the partnership? I mean, the point about artists as opposed to business is that they, how should we say, prima donna behavior is part of the territory, isn't it?
It is, and it's a good lesson to be learned from both perspectives, is that how should John and George have handled, John and Paul have handled George, knowing that he was this person. But as even in the anthology, Paul says, yeah, George was always, he was a year and a half, maybe 2 years younger than I was. So he was just a little kid, and perhaps I treated him as a kid too much, or as a child I should have done it. But that's a lot of time when you're that age. And then George says, edited beautifully, I was 8 months older than Paul, and I'm 8 months younger, 8 months younger than Paul, and I'm 8 months younger than Paul today. So they really looked down upon him, and they should have gained more respect, I think, as time went on. But it was also apparent that George was the least happy Beatle of all. He was ready to quit being a Beatle in 66, it seems. And, they kept bringing him back into the group. They could have handled him better. And then the other question in business and in the Beatles way is, what if you're George Harrison? Is there any other way to handle it better than to be the way he is? But, George and Ringo were both just completely bored during the recording of Sgt. Pepper, probably the greatest rock and roll record of all time, of which they were half of the beneficiary of the royalties, and they both remember the sessions.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned Ringo got very upset when he discovered that Paul had dubbed in somebody else's drumming.
Right, yeah, his own, Paul's drumming. That's what Ringo said. It's been tough to be in a group with four drummers.
Yes, it's that pushing it. There's a sort of insensitivity all around. More noticeable with John, of course, who was totally arrogant. But Paul was a sort of sweetly smiling arrogance and self-assurance that must have every bit as galling, I suppose, for his partner.
It seems to have been to at least George and John. Ringo seemed to get along with all.
Well, I think that Ringo, out of all of them, he was the star actor in the movies. In Hard Day's Night and Help, Ringo was the one, and appeared with Peter Sellers, of course, in The Magic Christian.
Right. And you'll remember this being where you were at the time, is that Ringo was really a star player. He was a very well-known musician in Liverpool with Roy Storm and the Hurricanes. He already had a stage name. He wore the rings. He was flashy. And when the Beatles asked him to come on board at that point in their career, it was almost a step down to leave Roy Storm and come on board with the Beatles. But he did it, and it was wise, and it's a good thing for all of them. But it was a step down. Ringo was much more popular and more well-known in Liverpool at the time.
But actually, inside the music fraternity, as I remember, there was always left a bad taste. People sort of tended to disparage him because of the way Pete Best was treated when he was given the bum's rush out the band. It was a sensitive subject.
Oh, I would think so. Yeah, George got a black eye.
Well, we're coming towards the end now. Tell people why they should. If they buy your book about the Beatles, are they going to get a refreshing insight into the Beatles, or are they going to get a how I can become a millionaire in 6 months guide?
Well, they can get a how they can be a millionaire in 25 year guide, but actually just ways to improve their life and improve their business, with quite a bit of history on the Beatles. And we did interview 25 or 30 people, and we feel that we have some nuggets in there that have never been published or said printed anywhere before. So it's a great book for Beatles fans, and it's good for business people. It's very inspirational. People keep it on their desk. We're told we get letters, every day, emails and things of people who read two or three chapters a day. The chapters are only two or three pages a piece. There are 100 of them, but they don't need to be read in chronological order. So it's a book you can pick up and read for 5 or 10 minutes and put down and pick it up the next day. So we had a great time writing it. We both thought we were Beatles experts, and we've learned more writing it than we knew.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed reading it. You enjoyed writing it. What could be better? Thanks very much, Richard. This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and I've been talking to Richard Courtney, a co-author with George Cassidy, of Come Together, The Business Wisdom of the Beatles, a fun read from a native Liverpudlian. That must be a high compliment.
Thank you.
Listen in next week to the Catskill Review of Books from WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.